From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, coming out from the shadow of a famous literary father, we'll talk with Benjamin Cheever. After editing a book of letters by his father, the late John Cheever, Ben has written his first novel, in which he says he finally found his own voice. Also, we meet actress Amy Madigan. She co-starred in Field of Dreams and Streets of Fire. Now she's playing Stella in the Broadway production of A Streetcar Named Desire. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sister Act, the new comedy starring Whoopi Goldberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House today declassified an edited version of a controversial policy document that established policy toward Iraq 10 months before the invasion of Kuwait. It's called National Security Decision Directive 26. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
NSDD 26 says that normal relations with Iraq are in the longer-term interests of the U.S. and that the U.S. should use economic and political incentives for Iraq to moderate its behavior and increase U.S. influence in Baghdad. In order to develop access to and influence with the Iraqi defense establishment, the document says the U.S. should consider non-lethal forms of military assistance, such as training courses. At the same time, NSDD 26 also says the U.S. will seek political and economic sanctions if Iraq uses chemical or biological weapons, or if it tries to develop nuclear weapons. It also says that human rights should be an important element of U.S. policy. The document was released at the request of Democratic Congressman Sam Gaydenson of Connecticut. He and other Democrats are charging that what they call the shameful coddling of Saddam Hussein was a major foreign policy blunder. Republicans say there's no evidence of a conspiracy or a cover-up and that the entire controversy is an election year charade. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Croatia called on the United States today to send Navy vessels to protect the historic port of Dubrovnik from attack by the Yugoslav Federal Army. Croatia's foreign minister said that Dubrovnik came under an artillery attack by Serbian-led Yugoslav forces. The shelling was said to be the worst attack on the city in 6 months. In an interview on British television, Croatia's foreign minister asked that the vessels of the U.S. 6th Fleet be sent to protect Dubrovnik. Israeli authorities have indefinitely extended the total closure of the occupied Gaza Strip. Gaza workers and other residents have been prevented from leaving the Gaza Strip since the killing Sunday of a 15-year-old Israeli schoolgirl by a Gaza resident. Patricia Golan reports.
Defense authorities today extended the closure order on the Gaza Strip, where a second Israeli, a Jewish rabbi, was fatally stabbed on Wednesday. In the Tel Aviv suburb of Bat Yam, where the teenage girl was killed, anti-Arab riots continued all week, with hundreds of demonstrators arrested. Gaza is home to 750,000 Palestinians and is heavily dependent on income from jobs in Israel. Police say they may consider lifting the closure, but allow only married men over the age of 30 to enter Israel. But for now, the area is totally sealed off. This coming Sunday, Palestinians from the occupied territories will be barred from entering Jerusalem when Israel marks the 25th anniversary of the unification of the city as a result of the 1967 Six-Day War. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost almost 2 points to close at 3,396. This is NPR. The United States said today that talks aimed at implementing guidelines for arms sales to the Middle East have failed to reach agreement. The talks among the world's five top arms exporting nations have been in progress for 2 days. The five leading weapons producers are the United States, Britain, France, China, and the republics of the former Soviet Union. Thailand's ruling parties postponed naming a new prime minister today out of fears of a public backlash. The country's been without a leader since Sunday when Prime Minister Suchinda Kraprayun was forced to step down after bloody anti-government protests. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Bangkok.
Pro-military parties in Thailand are struggling to hold on to power in the wake of Suchinda's resignation. This week they nominated another military man, Air Chief Marshal Somphun Rahong, to be the new prime minister. But the parties postponed presenting Somphun's name to the king for his approval today because of fears of a public backlash. Pro-democracy activists have vowed to stage new protests if Sombun is chosen. They accuse him of being a front man for the military. There is broad public anger at the pro-military parties for last week's crackdown on street demonstrations in which hundreds of people were killed or injured. Meanwhile, there are growing fears in Bangkok that the military may try to seize power once again. New rumors of a coup sent the stock market plunging in the early hours of trading. I'm Deborah Wong in Bangkok.
U.S. officials in Haiti said today that they've called in extra staff members to help the heavily burdened U.S. consulate handle the Haitian refugees who are being returned under President Bush's latest order. As of today, almost 1,000 people were returned to Haiti without being interviewed to determine whether they were eligible for political asylum. Processing for the returned refugees was slow, and many complained that they were given nothing to eat. For the first time, the U.S. consulate handed out applications at dockside to the returnees who wished to seek political asylum. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Benjamin Cheever's father was a brilliant and complicated man who has become the subject of some of Benjamin's own work. Ben has edited a collection of his father John Cheever's letters and wrote the introduction to a book of his father's journals, both published posthumously. John Cheever wrote what has been described as among the most nearly perfect short stories in English. But his stories about middle-class suburban life didn't prepare people for the life that was revealed in the letters and journals. Cheever was an alcoholic and led a secret double life as a bisexual. Benjamin Cheever's new book is a novel, his first, but his father still figures into it. The new novel, The Plagiarist, is about a young married man who is an editor at a magazine modeled on Reader's Digest, where Ben worked for 11 years. The father in the novel is a brilliant writer and an alcoholic. There's a scene in this comic novel where the editor-in-chief of the magazine tries to persuade the main character to get his famous father to write a story for the magazine. Here's a reading.
James Horster, the deputy editor-in-chief, leaned back in his chair contentedly. "I have to tell you that I was surprised at the success we had," he said. "Frankly, I was afraid that your father wouldn't come to lunch. I thought he might be too much of an egghead for us. The Adlai Stevenson School, if you know what I mean. But he seemed so down to earth. He really was delightful. Do you know if he reads the magazine regularly?" "No," said Arthur, and then apologetically, "he doesn't read a lot of magazines. Mostly he reads novels. He has to read a lot of novels. He's on panels." I see," said Horster, trying to hide his disappointment. "Well, in any case, I think now that we should go ahead with my project of getting him to write for us. I'll be entirely frank with you, Arthur. We don't have any place in the American Reader for a sort of New Yorker story. You know those clever pieces of fiction they run, where nothing happens but you feel a little sad about it anyway. Isn't there a name for that sort of story?" "Slice of life?" asked Arthur. "No, I don't think that's it," said Horster. "Whatever they're called, we don't want one." "But your father," said the deputy editor-in-chief, and he wagged his head appreciatively. "Every time he opens his mouth, it's a story. We must get him to write an original for us. I think it would be best if you approached him about it first. The trick here is coming up with just the right subject. Of course, your father should write this story to his own high standards, but it's important for us to get him off on the right foot, so to speak." "I think when my father writes a story," said Arthur, "he likes to come up with the idea himself." "And that must be the hardest part," said Horster, "which is why I'm so sure he'll be delighted to get some help. Now, we've already closed January, and it's probably too late for February, but if we got the first draft in a month or so, we'd be set for April or March." "I believe my father usually hands in finished copy," said Arthur.
That's Ben Cheever reading from his new novel. Did a story like this happen when you were working on Reader's Digest? Did they try to get you to get a story from your father?
Well, in fact, this is fiction. Nothing in this happened. But, in fact, my father was invited to lunch at the Reader's Digest and was asked if he would write a story for them. And, in fact, he did write a story, not originally for them, but which they finally ran. So while what happened in this book didn't exactly happen, I'm convinced that it all easily could have happened. There's a lot of stuff in there about the magazine that I think is quite plausible. There's the passing off of fiction as nonfiction. That kind of thing used to happen. And I, in fact, once sold an article to the magazine under somebody else's name, which was supposed to be nonfiction, which I had made up.
Now, in the novel, the main character writes a piece and says his father wrote it, and he submits it to the magazine. This gave you the chance to try to kind of parody your father's style. What were some of the traits you wanted to get in to that piece?
Well, you know, I wasn't so interested. Of course, I've always wanted to write like my father, and tragically, I don't. But the thing that was interesting to me about that metaphorically was I couldn't write a piece as good as his. I mean, I think his writing's beautiful in a way that I've given up on. I mean, I think writing could be useful without being beautiful. But I could write, it seems to me, a piece that other people who claim to be admirers of him might mistake for his. In other words, I can produce the form of his writing, but not the substance of it. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who accept form for substance.
How much do you think your father's style has influenced your own?
Well, I was terribly and still am very deeply influenced by my father, not just his style, but his life. I think the only reason I want to be a writer is because he was a writer. We all belonged to a cult, and he was the priest, and the faith was prose. I spent many years attempting to imitate his style. I even tried to write newspaper articles in his style, and I wasn't terribly good at it. And the best I could do was kind of comic. You know, it was not quite the right thing. Then I realized that that was a mistake, that I should write in my own voice.
This is your first novel, and I'm wondering if you think you could have written a novel while your father was still alive. What by that I mean, would the thought of him reading it and passing judgment on it have made it impossible for you to write?
That, you know, that's a good question. I like to think that if he'd lived another 15 years, and he might easily have, that things would have gone along the way they did, only better, but I don't know. He did once say to me when I was quite young, he knew I was ambitious to be a writer, although we did talk about it directly. He did once ask me if I wanted to write a novel, and I said I couldn't afford it, and he asked how much money I would need, and I said I would need $10,000, and he said, oh, well, I'll write you a check for $10,000, and I said, no, thank you. So, I think if I'd accepted a check for $10,000 and left my job in order to stay home and write a novel, I probably would have written nothing for 10 months and then shot myself, is my guess. But he was ambivalent about my writing, but he could be encouraging at times. And I think he would have, you know, when it was time for me to change in my life, usually we were able to come to an accommodation. There might have been hostility along the way.
What did you want from him as a father and as a reader? Encouragement for your writing or complete honesty?
Well, he was... he used to say that we operated on a level of absolute candor, and this was clearly a lie. It was a brilliant lie because I didn't know some of the very, very basic things about him. I didn't know that he was actively bisexual. What I really wanted from him was encouragement, and he did give me encouragement in other areas. I always had a fantasy that he would take, not always, but when I got to be a man, when I got to be 20, I had a fantasy that he would say, now I'm going to teach you how to write. And he would just, you know, we would sit at a typewriter together, and he would be professorial, and I would be blessed by this. It never happened, but he never really did that with anyone else either, although he did have protégés.
Now, your father was often published in The New Yorker. You were editing at Reader's Digest, and they really seem like the opposite magazines, you know, The New Yorker being the intellectual literary magazine, Reader's Digest being the much more kind of pop supermarket sales type of magazine. How did it feel to you to be working at Reader's Digest?
Well, certainly they're opposites, and I think... There are wonderful things about the Reader's Digest magazine. There are wonderful things about the people who read it. But I was always a little embarrassed. I think that many editors at The Reader's Digest were a little embarrassed. On the other hand, when the old people were alive, when Wallace and Lila were alive...
The founders of the magazine.
You knew that they believed very strongly that the magazine was a force for good, and that took the fact that you weren't... that you weren't esteemed at cocktail parties, that took the sting out of it, because you felt that maybe you were doing good works, even if they were a little ridiculous.
When you were an editor at Reader's Digest, did you have to edit pieces with titles like your character had to edit, such as Does Monogamy Promote Longevity, Henry Ford, Genius Americanus, and Blueberries, Feast on a Bush?
Articles just like that, and there were a lot of joke articles, which were, you know, when the Digest... condensed the Bible, the joke going around was, well, I know it'll begin with an anecdote. And the other was that they knew the whole Bible was gonna read, in the beginning was the end. And the other joke digest titles, maybe some of what you heard, were Red China, colon, Threat or Menace. There were articles that seemed, in fact, I did once have a man who was my superior and quite a much more talented then editor than I was at the Digest tell me, you know, it should be almost parody. It should be almost parody. So some of those are, yeah, some of the titles were really quite hilarious, yeah.
So maybe working at Reader's Digest kind of in its own unsuspecting way helped you along as a humorist, because you needed irony to get by there.
Well, I think you need irony to get by everywhere.
Anywhere, yeah. True enough. In your novel, The Plagiarist, the main character is very distant from his father. Doesn't see him much. Doesn't even call after his father is briefly in the hospital. Were you as distant from your father?
Usually my father and I were quite close. There was a period when we didn't get along. For a couple of years, and I've kind of dramatized it, but we got along fairly well. We fought. He used to say, and the Icarus character says in the book that he only remembers us fighting once. But we used to fight. But we were you could be quite intimate with him. He wasn't the kind of man many adult males in this country. You never get to know what they're thinking. You never see their doubt. You never see their fear. You never get close to them. That wasn't true of my father. And we spent a lot of time together talking and joking and disagreeing, squabbling.
The father in your novel says to the son, "We're both intelligent men, but when we spend time together, we talk as if we're living in a short story written for the Ladies' Home Journal." Did your father ever say that to you?
No, he didn't, but it's just the kind of thing he would have said.
Talk like that can make you mighty self-conscious about even conversing casually.
Well, I was very self-conscious, but so was he. And if you used a word incorrectly, and I frequently did, or if you acted in some other way that he found unacceptable, he could be quite harsh. And he was very talented at being harsh. When he said something nasty... it really stung. He really remembered it. And frequently he'd say it in such a way as to get by your guard. He'd say, "Oh, I hate to bring this up, but you are just absolutely the least coordinated boy in this neighborhood," something like that. So you'd feel, not that he was trying to hurt you, but that he had, against his will, to make this terrible confession about the fact that you were an outcast and frightfully uncoordinated. But, you know, that's been a blessing in a way, because I think everyone in our family, my sisters included, my brothers included, my mothers included, we all know how important language is. We've all had to defend ourselves against language for years and years, and for that reason, it's all so precious to us, important to us.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Cheever, and he's just written his first novel called The Plagiarist. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ben Cheever is my guest, and he's just written his first novel, The Plagiarist. We spoke on Fresh Air, I guess it was around 3 or 4 years ago, when the volume of your father's letters was published, which you wrote an introduction for and had edited. And since then, a book of his journals has been published, and you worked on that as well. It was edited by Robert Gottlieb, but I know you worked on that book. Have you ever had any second thoughts about making public the letters and journals of your father now that it's been a while and that it's had a chance to have its kind of ripple effect in the literary world?
Well, I'm very glad you asked that question about the journals, and I wrote an introduction to the journals. He made a big point at the end of his life, when we were close, of telling me that he wanted the journals published, of asking me to read them. I think this is partly a confessional thing he was doing with me, but it was clear that he wanted them published. Once it was clear to me that he wanted the journals published, then the question of the letters became secondary. The letters, as offensive as they may be to some people, are not nearly as offensive as the journals in terms of the intensity of his bisexual passions. I think that's mostly what people are offended by. So I sometimes wish there was an easier way, but it's very clear that this is what he wanted. And I also I commend his, I agree with his decision. So no, I haven't had second thoughts. Yes, I've had anguish about it, but I've never thought I shouldn't have done this. No.
You said when he showed you his journals, you thought it was a confessional thing that he was doing with you. You mean to let you know about his life and about things that he had kept hidden without having to tell you? You could read about it. There could be a little distance.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right.
Do you often think about how your life would have been different, how your father's life would have been different, if he had been more public about the things that he kept secret? If he hadn't lived a double life, in other words.
I don't think about that, because a double life was so essential to his character. You know, he was, that's how he was. He was divided in a very essential way, right at the beginning, all the way through him was this deception. So it's not possible for me to imagine my father as being different than that. I do sometimes think that it would have been, that my life might have been easier if I'd figured out earlier what was going on. But I fault myself, really, because he blustered. You know, he'd make a statement and then he'd bluster, and I was sufficiently cowed to accept the statement. I think if I had my life to live over, I'd be a little more canny about that.
You said you were really surprised when you read your father's journals to see how little you figured into them. Were you insulted by that, or do you think maybe he left you out of a sense of protecting you?
No, I think he left me out in the same way he left most people out, because he, at least when he was writing his journals, which are not his whole life, but at least that band of his life, he was really just interested in himself. And also, you read anything. You read the local newspaper. You look for your name, and if you find it less, you're disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think he was protecting me. I think that the worst things that he thought about me appear in those journals, and also the best.
One of each?
Well, there was a scene where I broke up with I was fighting with a girlfriend and was very furious at him, and wrote this letter to the girlfriend about what a creep I thought he was. And he just bought me a new car. And I have such terrible handwriting that I had to copy the letter out in order to send it to the girlfriend, otherwise she wouldn't have been able to decipher it. And I put the original in the waste paper basket, and he picked it up and read it, and then writes piously in his journal that he assumes I left the letter out for him to read, and comes to all these really damning conclusions about my character. and I was offended by that.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, Gottlieb thought it belonged in this volume of journals, and so it's there. And that's, I guess, about the worst thing he thought about me. But there's also loving. There's also loving stuff. The other worst thing he thought about me, which is not wounding, was that he always suspected me of being homosexual myself. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but he thought it was a bad thing. and I'd go off with a friend of mine, and he'd think we were doing something unspeakable in the woods instead of picking blueberries. In fact, we were picking blueberries. But I'm not offended by that because I really see that as his problem, not mine. Although it was wounding when I was a kid to have him be angry at me because he'd suspected something that I didn't know what he was getting at.
Your family has been so public about the family life. What do you think it is about your family that's made it? Because, you know, your sister Susan has also written fiction and nonfiction pertaining to the family.
Well, we, for one thing, we couldn't escape it. He was always writing stories in which people, not us, but people quite similar to us, sometimes people with our least desirable characteristics, were revealed to the world. And sometimes readers are not very canny. Sometimes they would read a story about a sad little boy and they'd think that was me. My mother says that she remembers going to the supermarket after a story had run in The New Yorker in which the female lead is really quite an odious character. And a neighbor came up to her and said, I just read that article about you in The New Yorker. So we were all exposed to a very large extent, and he was always exposing himself, too. So it wasn't the step for us that it might have been for anyone else. And we also confided in each other. He was not complete in his confidences. I think the rest of us were. I would tell him there was nothing. There was nothing I would do or think that I didn't feel that I could confide to him. Really nothing.
You have a children. You have children now, and you're married. This is a second marriage. It's not the marriage you referred to earlier. And I wonder if you want to be as open with your own family and as public about their lives as your family has been about that part of the family.
Well, you're assuming interest. I don't think there's I don't think there's going to be a great interest in the details of our life. It's really fairly ordinary. I hope, you know, it seemed to me, now maybe this is just something I made up to make myself feel better, to justify my struggles, but when I was done with the first draft of this novel and it was turned down by a couple of publishers, I was very depressed. I went for a run, I was able to run a 7:30 mile, which is really quite quick, and cry at the same time, which I'm, it's kind of a biathlon. Anyway, it occurred to me that if I failed as a writer, I would mean that I would that my frustration, that my unhappiness would be imprinted on my children. So what I hope to do, you hope to take down, I think every parent does, the things from your parents that you admire, and leave off the things you don't. So I hope they get from me some feeling of personal responsibility, a feeling that I had from my father, that I love them very much, that I'm besotted with them, as he was with us, really. But I hope they don't get from me, as I got from him, a terrible uncertainty about their sexuality.
Mm. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Benjamin Cheever. His new novel is called The Plagiarist. It's just been published by Athenaeum. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Amy Madigan played Kevin Costner's supportive wife in the movie Field of Dreams. She was a tough munitions expert in the hip action film Streets of Fire. Now she's on Broadway in a revival of Streetcar Named Desire. Coming up, we'll talk to Amy Madigan about playing Stella alongside Alec Baldwin's Stanley Kowalski. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sister Act, the new comedy starring Whoopi Goldberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Bush visited South Central Los Angeles today, stopping at one of 10 disaster application centers and speaking with victims of the civil unrest. Later, he addressed members of the Town Hall of California, a nonpartisan group that hosts speakers from around the world. Frank Stoltz of station KLON reports.
President Bush said Los Angeles has a long way to go in recovering from the unrest of 4 weeks ago, but added he was impressed by the courage of those struggling to rebuild their lives and businesses. He reiterated his long-held position that government's primary role is to maintain law and order, not spend millions of dollars trying to solve social problems.
We spent more money in the 80s than we did in the 70s, more in the 70s than in the 60s. And for all the good intentions, decay and despair have only seeped deeper and deeper into our inner cities.
What's needed, the president said, is less regulation so businesses will set up shop in the inner cities and a moral revival of family values. Though billed as a fact-finding trip, the president's journey comes just 4 days before the California primary. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
White House officials say President Bush will unveil a tropical forest initiative at next week's Earth Summit in Brazil. The president is expected to announce his plan in a major environmental speech on Monday, which officials hope will deflect growing criticism from environmentalists over a number of recent actions. These include allowing logging of old-growth timber in the Pacific Northwest and easing industry regulations under the Clean Air Act. The White House also pushed for a weaker treaty on global warming to be signed at the Earth Summit. The historic Croatian port of Dubrovnik has come under heavy bombardment from the Yugoslav Army and Navy, 3 days after residents celebrated the apparent withdrawal of Serbian troops from the city. Pierre Vickery reports the attack is the most serious in 6 months, causing considerable damage to several historic buildings.
Croatian state television broadcast pictures said to have been taken in Dubrovnik this morning, showing damaged buildings in the historic town center with shattered glass, remnants of sculpted masonry littering the streets. The Serbian attack had begun in the early afternoon, forcing 70,000 residents to take refuge in basement shelters as federal warships offshore and artillery and mortar batteries in the hills overlooking Dubrovnik launched a fierce bombardment of the town. Fighting was also reported in the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, with Serbian artillery and multiple rocket carriers launching what residents described as the heaviest day shelling so far in the two-day war. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 1.5 points to close at 3396.88. Advances led declines 10 to 7. This is NPR News. Democrats stepped up their charges today that the Bush administration coddled Iraq prior to its invasion of Kuwait in 1990. At a House committee hearing today, lawmakers pointed to newly declassified documents that show the president backed military and economic aid to Iraq. Democrats called it a foreign policy blunder of the first order and claimed that the White House is now mounting an elaborate cover-up to preserve its Gulf War record. Republicans countered, "It's easy to criticize in hindsight." Ross Perot held a rally by satellite today, appearing in Orlando, Florida. Perot also spoke with supporters in Ohio, Kansas, Alabama, and Idaho. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Sounding like the presidential candidate he is expected to become in just a few weeks, Perot congratulated the crowd for getting him on the ballot in 9 states so far. And he pledged again to be the voter's servant if he is elected. He talked about the importance of reducing the national debt, of creating more jobs and of making the melting pot of America work again. But he provided no specifics on how he might accomplish any of those goals. Perot is expected to continue to use this electronic method of campaigning, substituting satellite rallies for traditional in-person campaign stops. Other candidates must storm the country in hope of getting free media coverage on the network TV shows. But Perot, with hundreds of millions of dollars to spend, can buy as much TV exposure as he needs. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide says he agrees with the U.S. decision to repatriate Haitian refugees. Speaking to reporters in New York, Aristide said the best way to stem the flow of refugees was to reinstate democracy. He also called for tougher economic sanctions on Haiti. An Organization of American States embargo has tightened oil and food supplies, but not all countries adhere. Aristide was toppled in a military coup last September. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A streetcar named Desire has been revived in a Broadway production starring Alec Baldwin, Jessica Lange, and my guest Amy Madigan, who plays Stella. Like her co-stars, Madigan is best known for her movie roles. She played Kevin Costner's wife in Field of Dreams, a tough mercenary in Streets of Fire, and in the made-for-TV movie Roe v. Wade, she starred as the lawyer who won the case that legalized abortion. She told me she knows that many people in the audience of Streetcar are comparing this new production with earlier ones.
People have very strong opinions about the play, and they also have very strong opinions about it because a lot of people have seen the film, which was, of course, so powerfully and wonderfully done, and people kind of remember Marlon Brando so much from that. But we're doing the play, and the play we are doing is Tennessee Williams' text with every period and comma and stage direction and cross T and dotted I. And the play is very different from the film. It really centers much more on the relationship between Stella and Blanche, the two sisters, and it's been a very exciting experience working on it.
I'll confess I haven't read the play.
Have you ever seen a production of it?
In all honesty, I have not.
Mm-hmm.
I have not.
So you've seen the movie.
The movie, right.
Yeah.
Of the most famous scene is the Stella scene.
Right.
So tell me how that's played in the Broadway production.
Well, it's quite wonderful, I think. Alec has taken this approach with Stanley to really let his emotional side come through, that you just don't see the brute, the vulgarity. You see this other side to him. So in his calling for me and his leading up to it, which he phones up to the apartment upstairs, and it's quite, it's very pathetic in a way. It's quite sad. And you see the true vulnerability of this man. And finally, he has to yell at the top of his voice, Stella! And I finally have to come down those stairs, you know. And I think we figured out a really beautiful and nice way to do it. You can kind of feel it in the audience when we're connected and doing it right, that people are, in a way, cheering for this relationship, although they know how the story is going to end, and it ends tragically. And it's a nice palpable feeling that you get from the audience when they see the love that these two people do have for each other.
In the Stella scene, do you ever get a little shiver thinking that now that scene's about you? I think we all grew up hearing, not only seeing the scene in the movies, but hearing people impersonate over and over Brando doing it.
Oh, every boy I went to school with at one time or another was imitating Stella.
Mm-hmm.
That scream.
Yeah.
Very early on in the rehearsal process, which we spent a lot of time sitting down and around the table as opposed to getting up on our feet very quickly, so we could really, really know the text with each other, which was quite invaluable. And it just happened kind of in this collective way. We all very, very quickly forgot about any movie version, any onus about it, any other production we had seen, because we finally were becoming these people. So when I hear that plaintive wail calling for me, it's for me. It's not about anybody else or anything else. And that's why you love to do it, because it's the magic of doing theater.
The first role I saw you in the movies was Streets of Fire, the 1984 movie. I'm going to ask you to describe your part.
Well, first of all, I had a great time working on Streets of Fire. I played a character called McCoy. I wore the same outfit for the entire film, and it was a long shooting schedule, so that was rather interesting. The part was written for a Hispanic male of about 40 who was kind of over the hill, drank too much, was a mercenary type of character on and off. This is a fantasy type movie. And he really needs a job, and he hooks up, of course, with the somber and sexy hero. And then there was a part for the sister. And I went in and met Walter Hill, who I like very much, and said, "Mr. Hill, I don't want to be the sister, nothing against the sister, but I think that I should be the hero's sidekick. And I can do all the things that are required. Don't change the dialogue. Don't change the weaponry. Don't change the action. And won't this just be, don't you think my idea is better than yours?" Basically is what I said. And he was open enough and not intimidated, certainly, and said, "Yeah, that's a good idea. Can you really pull it off?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I can." So there's an example of my big Irish mouth not getting me in trouble. And I don't know. I just kind of like to think that I was a little bit of a prototype for a lot of these tough gals that are running around now.
I think probably the movie that you've made that the most people have seen is Field of Dreams. And you were the wife of the character played by Kevin Costner in it. Did you have any reservations about taking the wife of role? How did that role look to you when you read it?
Well, I was familiar with W.P. Kinsella, the writer. And I had not read Shoeless Joe, but I had read some of his other novels. And he has some great writings about the Indians. And I just liked the script a lot. And when I met the director, Phil Robinson, I liked him a lot. So it was something that I wanted to be involved in. You know, I liked the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I auditioned, and as many other women did, and they, you know, chose me, which I'm very happy that they did. Kind of when I was referring before to Walter's film, I kind of said the sister. Or,
mm-hmm.
I'm married. I am a wife. I don't have any problem with that. It's just, oftentimes in the writing, you're kind of written as really the wife, the girlfriend, the aunt, the sister, without any dimension or passion or kind of anything going on, you know. And that, I think, is a common complaint that a lot of actresses would have. But because Field of Dreams was kind of this beautiful magic story, I just found it fun and exciting. It was something I wanted to be a part of.
My guest is Amy Madigan. She plays Stella in the new Broadway revival of A Streetcar Named Desire. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Madigan, and she's currently starring on Broadway in A Streetcar Named Desire. Before you started acting, you were in rock bands. I think you spent around 10 years.
Yeah, almost 10 years doing that.
Singing?
Yes, I was an upfront vocalist. Sometimes I would play weird percussion instruments like a concert snare or a glockenspiel or a vibratone or castanets. And sometimes I play a second keyboard on a few things. And it was just great. I just love music, and I got into the band situation kind of as soon as I left home and went away to school. And I guess for somebody else it would be like their woodshedding process of being in you know, carrying the spear on stage or being in the summer stock shows or being in rep theater or whatever. And I always did original material with all the bands I was in, so I have great reverence and still do for whatever the script is and whoever the writer is, which unfortunately sometimes in our business gets, they're treated badly. Like, I can't quite understand that, you know, unless it's on the page, you can be acting your butt off, but if you don't have it on the page, it's not going to go, you know.
What kind of music?
A weird combination of kind of almost avant-garde Zappa-esque instrumentals, some performance art type of pieces. Before the term performance art existed, I would play characters on stage. And then one of the partners I worked with wrote just unbelievably beautiful blue-eyed soul type music. So we did kind of a, you know, Marvin Gaye, Tammy Terrell, rhythm and blues type of stuff, which I really enjoyed singing. So it was an eclectic mixture. We weren't one thing, and I guess that wasn't very good business sense, but we really kind of didn't care that much.
How far did you get? I noticed you left.
Yeah. What do you mean by that question, Terry? How far did you get?
I mean, in the music business.
Oh, I didn't get far at all in the music business. Yeah, and I did leave. I was a working musician, and I was able to play wonderful places. I mean, I played bars and joints, and I also played Avery Fisher Hall. You know, I was very lucky and was able to open up for some people that I admired.
Like who?
Stevie Goodman, Dan Hickson, the Hot Licks, Steely Dan, just to name a few. They were, and Flo and Eddie, actually. And one of the bands I was in, we did record an album to which my parents and a few other family members have copies of, and that's about it. I never had any great success or acclaim in the business side of it. And maybe if I had, I would have taken a different path in life, but I think I definitely, when I took a right turn from music into the acting, I know it was the right thing to do, and I have no regrets about it, and I'm very glad I did it.
Now, I have to ask you, your father was a newsman.
Yeah, my father still is.
Oh, is still a newsman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's he up to now?
He does a show for CBS Radio called Views the Press in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's become the press liaison between the press and the Illinois Supreme Court. So that's been kind of interesting, being a member of the press for that period of a time. He kind of knows how to handle everybody.
And his name for our listeners who will recognize him as John Madigan.
John Madigan from CBS in Chicago, yes.
What effect did it have on you to grow up with a father in the news business? Did you talk about issues all the time at the dinner table?
We talked about a lot of things, yes. And when my dad was news director for CBS television in Chicago, we always had three televisions that were constantly on because you had to check your competition and see what their stories were about and lead stories. And the radios were always on. So you kind of were just battered in a way with this barrage of kind of information. But I was also able to meet some people that I probably wouldn't have met, you know, as a young kid even, politicians. And so it was just kind of a part of our life. And so we all were very involved in that. And I thank my dad for that because I'm still politically active and I'm still a big newsprint buff as opposed to a television news person, although now CNN has kind of changed that.
Right.
So it was something that was always, yeah, always there and always around. Still is when I go home. The radios are still blasting the news out.
Right, right.
Right.
Now, we are recording this interview, and the time now is 3:19 Eastern Time. You have a performance of Streetcar tonight. What happens between now and curtain time? What do you have planned?
Well, I will go over to, from here I'll go over to the theater, which is a little early, but that's okay. I have some things to do over there. But I am the type of person that I like, there's a thing in the theater called half hour, which is you have to be there a half hour before your performance. I would be a blithering idiot if I got there a half hour before. I usually get to the theater 3 to 4 hours before a performance. And spend quiet time with myself, burn my candles, put on different kinds of music. Music is a very emotional link for me to acting work. It's very visceral and it's very physical, and I use different pieces of music. Warm up my throat. Continually read the play. I'll pull out a scene that I know backwards and forwards, but I'll sit down and read it, because in that way of you just putting your presence in front of the play itself by reading it, you'll kind of sometimes will figure out some magical, wonderful little thing that you never thought about. I go down and check my props, walk on the stage, and it's kind of an internal preparation to get ready to do the show.
When you say burn my candles, you mean literally, right? That's not just...
Yeah, you know. I have my little candles that I like to burn.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of music have you been listening to for Streetcar?
I've been listening to a lot of jazz music, and I love jazz music. I was very turned on to it. I have two older brothers, and my eldest brother is a big, big, big jazz buff. So he really got me into listening to jazz when actually I was quite young. So I've been listening to a lot of jazz, not just New Orleans jazz where the play takes place, but Bessie Smith, been listening to that, and more of the old time kind of blues stuff, Professor Long here.
Mm.
And sometimes I'll just have to put on Eric Clapton on 10. And just and listen to that, or Stevie Ray Vaughan, I have to listen to a 6-string guitar just be played incredibly great, so it's kind of I'll go to either extreme.
So I guess when you get to the theater, you'll just have a little under 4 hours.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'll let you go and start getting ready. I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. I really like your show a lot, and it's nice for me to be talking with you.
Amy Madigan plays Stella in the Broadway revival of A Streetcar Named Desire. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we have a report today on President Bush's foreign policy, a look back at what he's done in office as president. Also, a report on National Security Directive 26. It has now been made public, or at least most of it, we think, has been made public. It was the directive in which the president, in 1989, set out policy toward Iraq. This was well before, or about a year or so before, the invasion of Kuwait. We'll also hear today from Linda Wertheimer about a new state legislative district in California that's been carved out to try to elect a Hispanic representative, and why state elections there may be much more competitive than in the past.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Emil Artelino directed theater and dance specials before he became a movie director with the surprise hit Dirty Dancing in 1987. But after that, the hits stopped coming, and some people speculated that what Artelino needed was a good musical to direct. Sister Act doesn't quite qualify, but it does have singing and dancing in it, and Touchstone Pictures is positioning it as a feel-good moneymaker. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Feel-good movies invariably make me feel terrible. And Sister Act, already the designated feel-good movie of the summer, felt to me like 96 minutes of Maylock's moments. Films like Sister Act, in fact, are as carefully formulated as antacids. And though this one isn't quite as well-balanced as last summer's hit City Slickers, it's got the same crowd-pleasing ingredients. A little bit of comedy, a lot of gush, a fish-out-of-water premise, an essential character who's living wrong and needs to reevaluate those values. In Sister Act, the comedy is mainly come-on. It's there to sugarcoat all that sugar. Trouble is, the jokes aren't terribly funny, and the premise is so familiar it's almost become a genre unto itself. In real life, when you're in trouble with A, the police, or B, the mob, it's a good idea to find a nice bungalow somewhere in Costa Rica. But in the movies, what you're supposed to do is disguise yourself as either a priest or a nun, and then spend the next 90 minutes stuck in some holy order somewhere, raising ecclesiastical eyebrows. In this case, Whoopi Goldberg is a struggling lounge singer in Reno who runs afoul of her boyfriend, a gangster played by Harvey Keitel. To protect her, the cops hide her in a San Francisco convent run by starchy Maggie Smith. Smith doesn't welcome the intrusion, but some of the younger sisters do, especially the dangerously cheery Sister Mary Patrick, played by Kathy Najimy. Here's Mary Patrick welcoming Sister Whoopi, or rather Sister Mary Clarence, to her first convent meal.
Reverend Mother, on behalf of all the sisters here at St. Catherine's, I'd like to offer a great big hi there and hello to Sister Mary Clarence. Hi. And as part of the welcome, I thought that maybe our new sister could offer today's blessing.
Well, that is very thoughtful of you, Mary Patrick, but I really...
Oh, I could do that. Sure. Bless us, O Lord, for these thy gifts which we're about to receive. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of no food, I will fear no hunger. We want you to give us this day our daily bread, and to the republic for which it stands, and by the power invested in me, I pronounce us ready to eat. Amen.
For Whoopi Goldberg's sister act is two steps backwards. After a movie career that seemed like one compromise after another, she was suddenly original and energetic in Ghost. She won her Supporting Actress Oscar for it. And then, as if to prove that wasn't a fluke, she gave a gorgeous, loosey-goosey performance in another supporting part in The Player. But here she is again in a starring role, and again she's turned soggy. After an initial tough-talking comic flurry or two, she gives herself a saintly glow and turns into Maria von Trapp, almost literally. Her job in the convent, it turns out, is to improve its ghastly choir. And predictably overnight, she does. Now, to the tune of My Guy, they sing My God. And we're supposed to giggle at the naughtiness of giving church music a rock beat. But hasn't anybody connected with this movie heard of black gospel music? Or maybe we're supposed to pretend that Whoopi isn't black. The movie was originally planned as a vehicle for Bette Midler, but when Whoopi came aboard, nobody bothered to change a thing. Director Emil Ardolino makes the musical numbers splash right along, but his movie would be insufferably dull if it weren't for a crew of terrific supporting actors, especially Kathy Najimy, who uses her dimply grin and her considerable heft to give Sister Mary Patrick's joie de vivre thermonuclear capabilities. Otherwise, Sister Act is a real stinker, and I'm afraid it's going to stink all the way to the bank.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. I'm Terry Gross.
No muscle-bound man could take my hand from my God, my God. No handsome face could ever take the place of my
Major
God.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Diary of a Human Shield. Glenda Lockwood and her family were among the hostages held in Iraq after the invasion of Kuwait. In an Iraqi video of Saddam Hussein speaking with the hostages, Saddam put his arm around Lockwood's younger son, but the boy refused to respond. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.